Hi everybody, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carroll, welcoming you to the weekly podcast from the Banter team. It's time to check back in again with Neil Strauss. A decade on from his best-selling book, The Game, Strauss has returned to the writing about the other sex business, but much has changed in the meantime. As he told us at MVP in Dublin a few weeks ago, when he joined us to talk about his new book, The Truth, an uncomfortable book about relationships. Or what happens when a dude who's all for freedom, sex and opportunity meets a woman he's prepared to have a long-term life with. Welcome to Banter here at the MVP. Please give a warm round of applause and welcome to Neil Strauss.
Are there some pillows or telephone books so people in the back can see our expressions? Or
With people in the back. Can people in the back see us?
They can see like the top of like the glint
two,
of the top of my head.
They can see two bald heads. Yeah. Will we take normal seats?
Let's do it.
One moment please, while we change our seats.
Or we can just stand up too.
Oh,
you don't banter standing up here. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Oh no, we're here.
Stools may be better. Yeah.
Might fall off the stools.
What's that?
Might fall off the stools.
You
might
make it like more exciting. And if anyone gets bored, there's chess downstairs, so it's very exciting.
We might look like two boy band survivors sitting on stools singing ballads.
Somehow, I doubt it.
We'll wait for the stools to arrive, but we'll do some kind of like small talk first.
Let's start.
Is this your first time in Dublin?
No, I've been here like 8 or 9 times, maybe.
Right.
Yeah. Great, thank you. That's much better.
Awesome.
We should keep going and just get higher and higher chairs. It'd be awesome.
Let's go back to your start before The Game. Like, tell us about your life before The Game. What you were doing, like what kind of work you were doing, and how you felt as a writer and a journalist.
Yeah, before The Game, I was writing for the New York Times for a bunch of years. Also writing at the same time for Rolling Stone, and just was interviewing bands, reviewing going to concerts, and did a bunch of books. I did a book on Motley Crue, toured with them for a couple of years. Did a book on Marilyn Manson, where basically almost lived with him for a year. Which was fun, and a book with Jenna Jameson, and everything I do, I kind of deep dive in. So when I did this book with Jenna Jameson, they needed someone to write her next porn movie, and I said, "I'm a writer, I'll do it," and so I wrote the movie, and it won the AVN Award for best porn video, and I'm sure it was because of the writing.
So let's talk a little bit about the Motley Crue book then. You know, I mean, you're writing for Rolling Stone, you're writing for New York Times, so you're used to hanging out with bands, you're used to kind of going on the road. Did the life on the road kind of like resemble what you expected, or did the boredom, the drudgery, and the sheer like completely same story day in day out begin to kind of like dawn on you? Okay, it's not as glamorous as it's made out to be.
Well, it's both, and it's interesting because I've gone on the road with a band as a journalist. When you go as a journalist, they just show you what they want you to see. But when I went as sort of a member of the band and a member of the entourage doing the book where I'm on the inside, it was like a totally different experience. And both things you say are true. It's really boring and there's a lot of drudgery. And because of that, and because they're so bored and can do whatever the fuck they want, they do a lot of insane, stupid things. So it's a little bit of both. I mean, I remember my first night out with like on the road with Marilyn Manson, they put out like a big CD. I guess this dates it because it's a CD case. I don't know what they're like, do the dust, and there are lines of white powder. And they said dust, so I'd like, is this coke or maybe it's like angel dust? I don't know. They're just saying dust. So I didn't, but I didn't want it to be, you know, I wanted to fit in. I wanted to like me, the story of my life. like all bad decisions begin like that, right? And so I kind of bent down. I kind of did the thing where I tried to like blow it out of my nose really slowly, so it looked like it was going up, but it was dissipating. And I just party fouled it and got the drugs everywhere. Turns out it was cocaine.
And like, was there any reaction from the band to your kind of like me pratfall?
There was some disappointment, but over time I got used to it. And I remember one day, and again, like I'm not running for office, so I can talk about this stuff. I remember one day, I noticed like I was getting really. This is after doing the book with them for a long time, so I remember I said, you know what? Because basically you'd hang out with them, you'd basically do like coke all night, then you do like wine and downers. You just kind of go up and down all night. And I remember one day we got like 4 movies to watch, and we watched all of them in 15 minutes somehow. I don't know how we did that. but I remember one day I noticed like Anyone done a lot of cocaine here? You can raise your hand. It's a podcast. No one can see you. Okay. So I remember one day I was like, someone's lying. So I said, you know, I just find that I'm like losing my temper all the time. I'm really temperamental. Like I get angry really easily. Like, does that happen with you guys? And one of the guys in the band goes, yeah, that's the best part. And that's when I stopped.
So okay, so after writing books about like rock stars and porn stars, where did the idea for the game come from then? Were you tapped for that, or did you approach an editor with the idea in the first place?
What happened was I had a book editor who called me up and said, hey, I found this underground community of these guys who call themselves pickup artists. They don't have money, they don't have looks, they don't have fame, but they've kind of cracked the code of seduction, turned it into a science. And do you want to write a kind of take their information together and do a how-to book? And I said, no way, I'm a serious writer, I'm a serious journalist, I write for the New York Times, I would never do something like that. And then secretly, I started checking out this community, not having looks, money, or fame, and always being like really, really like suffering through, I remember hanging out with Marilyn Manson and Motley Crue, like in this really privileged world where women are throwing themselves at the band and throwing themselves at you to get to the band, and I really couldn't make anything translate. It was almost a joke with the bands. Like I remember Marilyn Manson's manager was saying, remember once there was that girl over here, you were over at her house helping her paint her house, and she went on a date with another guy while you're helping her paint, while you're painting her house. Like, it was that bad.
So as you began to explore that scene then of those pickup artists, what traits were you noticing? What were you noticing about them that you could kind of say, okay, I can turn this into a book. There's bits and pieces here that I can use and kind of like I can do some reporting on, and I can actually kind of like show how this actually works.
So what was my mindset when I was doing it? Yeah, I was just thinking this is much. You should be on that. You should do this on TV. It's a much more casual, better interview. There's more laughter. We're having a good time.
There's more drink here. There's more drink. There's more cocaine.
Exactly.
This is gonna be a podcast. Yeah.
Now I remember, like on the Manson book tour. My book tours are boring. On his, I'd be like, this is what you do as a ghostwriter. I'd be chopping up his lines in the bathroom before we went out to do the signing. That was my job. I was the line chopper.
That's not the reason why Neil was late tonight.
Yeah, exactly. Ghostwriter and line chopper.
So go back to your mindset then. When you started exploring that world.
When I started exploring it, it was solely kind of selfishly for me, because really, like I'd be reviewing concerts all the time, so I'd meet someone at one concert and I was attracted, and I'd say, hey, I got this tickets to some other concert, why don't you come with me? And then she'd come with me to that concert, and then we'd hang out, and I'd try to talk to her until she liked me, and go for the, hey, man. He was riveted. And then I'd go for the kiss, and I'd get the cheek turn. There's an acronym in that game community, which is LJBF. You guys know what that is, right? Shout it out. Let's just be friends. I get the let's just be friends thing, and it was just horrifying. I was like, why not? What's wrong with me? So these guys, I really went in. I just started reading the stuff obsessively. Almost was like just discovering. I don't know what the example, what a metaphor would be. Just discovering this treasure trove of knowledge that I didn't have access to.
Mm. And did it strike you, Neil, that the knowledge is worth acquiring? I mean, it's really interesting. Like when I reread some of the game, I was reminded kind of like, it's like when you're reading some of the stuff as kind of an outsider to that scene, you're kind of going like, this cannot be true. Like, I mean, these things cannot work. These traits these tricks that are being talked about here cannot work in any way. Did you have some doubts? Did you have some kind of like, I suppose, kind of like cynicism about it to begin with? Or was it the case that as you progressed and realized this was working, you kept it going?
Yeah, I went in with absolutely no journalistic skepticism whatsoever. I think because I've been
reading... None whatsoever.
Because I've been reading all the stuff online and doing all this research and reading their like quote unquote field reports, that I really like. I could see there was something there, and there were different philosophies in schools, and I knew whatever I was doing wasn't working, so it wasn't going to hurt. I think if I went in skeptical and judgy, I wouldn't have learned. I think it's true of anything.
Mm. Okay, so then you morphed into style, and like you became kind of like, I mean, like a player. You like suddenly found yourself like one of the kind of people in the scene who was, I suppose, scoring a lot, like having a really, really good time. And the book came out of that. When the book was published, what was the reaction from the people that you were kind of like writing about?
Yeah, I think the weirdest point was before the book was published, and like it was the weirdest community again. Like, it's so weird that people would come up to me not knowing that I was a writer, an author, or a journalist. And I'd be like, I was style, and they'd take their photo with me as Style. Like, oh my God, it's Style. Like, it was the most bizarre shit. Like, I think, as far as like an alter ego, it's the weirdest thing that like could ever happen. And it was really bizarre. So that was already happening within the community. So I think that was like the first really strange point. And then when I told them, hey, I'm going to be writing about this. And as I was living with them, they got to know who I was. I think they were excited because they felt too, like there's something going on here. It's exciting. It's weird. It's bizarre. It's kind of cool. We're excited that someone's chronicling this. Mm.
And then the book sold 2.5 million copies.
Right.
You know, and when you look back now at that person, at that person who was kind of part of that scene and who kind of, I suppose, you know, learned the tricks, put the tricks into practice, compiled your own field reports, do you still recognize that person?
First of all, I can't read it, I definitely couldn't read anything or look at it. Probably like complete embarrassment. Yeah, yeah, that's probably the emotion.
Yeah, and like it's interesting because I mean, like that was 11 years ago. So I mean, so much has changed in society since then. Like, right. I mean, like in terms of kind of like, you know, you've got like things like Tinder, which wasn't around then. But also, you kind of like got, I suppose, a negative view of an awful lot of that culture. You know, you've got like the focus on rape culture. You've got the focus on kind of like catcalling. Like everything has kind of changed in those kind of 10 years. Do you think that scene, you know, that scene has taken all those changes into account?
Let's see. It's a very big question. So let me dive into some of that stuff. So first of all, probably if all the stuff was in the culture the way it is now, I probably wouldn't have done it. I think like when I was in it, even when I wrote the book, it seemed like there were two branches of the culture, and one was, hey, could this be sort of a positive self-improvement movement for men? And then the other side was, is this just like a really cheesy blip on the pop culture radar when men are walking around in like really stupid outfits saying dumb things, right? I felt it could go either way, but I didn't see like the real hateful side of it. There was one guy who was really kind of hateful and misogynist, and he was just a weird exception in that world, and that's all I kind of saw. But I think since then, that third path of self-hatred and other hatred and this confused code of masculinity that somehow thinks humiliating women and then bragging about it online makes you more of a man. It's horrifying.
And like, you know, obviously you talked there about three paths, you know, and the first two paths, you know, the pop culture blip and a bit of fun, you know, that was something you definitely wrote about in the game. That the third side, that kind of like that negative side, that misogynistic side, do you think that's something that's only kind of emerged really in the last couple of years?
Honestly, I don't think people change. I think it was always there, but because we had gatekeepers in the culture before, they didn't have a voice, right? But now you can go onto Reddit, you can start your own, you know, subreddit, you can gather all the people who have the same damaged wound that you have, and then you can have a voice, and that voice can terrify the culture because they're like, fuck, people think like that? I don't know if I want to live in a world with people thinking like that. Mm. So I think those voices, they were there, but they were alone. Mm. Now they found each other, and it's scary.
Yeah. So after the game was published, it sold all those kind of copies, and you became like a big celebrity. You know, like when you read the new book, when you read The Truth, it's like it's kind of, I kind of felt that a lot of the doubts you had and an awful lot of kind of like the problems you had began to emerge kind of after that, when things went into overload after the game, when you were a success, you were doing seminars, women were throwing themselves at you. Was that when kind of like you were supposed to, the doubts began to creep in?
I think, to be like brutally frank, I think it wasn't like, oh, the game led, I mean, let's see, the game, I think the game was a symptom of the wound that was healed in The Truth, if that makes any sense, right? So the wound was already there, and the attraction and the obsession with the pickup artist world was a symptom of that same wound. That finally got healed in The Truth, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the book, you talk about, like, I mean, you go through all these kind of like when you decided to go into therapy, and you basically they were kind of saying you discovered you had anxiety syndrome, depressive disorder, two forms of sexual disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. I mean, did you when you went into therapy to begin with, did you think you would come out with a shopping list like that?
It's a lot. You know, it's funny.
That's why I wrote it down.
And I'm brutally self-critical and really, you know, as much as I can. And I really think that laundry list of stuff, I definitely don't have, like, Yeah, I don't. It's weird. I just put it in there because that was my diagnosis at the end. But it was more to make the point of how easy it is to label. Like, you go into these places and they just label you like crazy. And I think it's only because I filled out stuff in a survey when I went in. Are you sad? Well, I'm sad. I'm in fucking rehab. Do I have anxiety? Fuck yes. You know, I'm scared because I'm in rehab. So I think because I filled out those things, they just sort of gave me a diagnostic criteria that will haunt me for the rest of my life.
Yeah. before you went into rehab, then, Neil, had you done therapy before? Had you kind of like been seen by someone before in your life?
No, this is the weirdest thing. And by the way, out of curiosity, how many people have read The Truth out of curiosity? Has anyone read it yet? Okay, a few people, so you kind of know what it's about. How many people have read The Game? Go, guys. How many people have read The Dirt, the Motley Crue book? Oh, you guys got to read that one. It's great, right? Yeah. So what happened was I thought I was the same person who wrote about the crazy people, who, you know, chronicled the hijinks of Motley Crue, Marilyn Manson, Janet Jameson, all my Rolling Stone articles, and even The Game. Like, it was really a book about, I was kind of the supposedly the normal one watching mystery and all these larger than life characters having their breakdowns. And the irony of this was I found out I was really just as crazy as all of them. And I would dare say, if you give me half an hour, any of you, I will prove that you are crazy as well. But when we all are, and we don't recognize it because we're so close to ourselves and living with ourselves, it's hard to see.
Yeah. After kind of like, I suppose you were in rehab, you know, it struck me from reading The Truth that you decided you wanted out in many ways. You wanted kind of like your commitment. You wanted a relationship. But at the same time, it's a very interesting thing a doctor said to you, which is like that your brain was hardwired in a certain way, that you were still thinking about, like, I mean, picking up women. That, like, I mean, that side of your brain, that compulsion was still there.
Yeah, it's interesting. So what happened was when I was trying to figure out why I can't be faithful and monogamous, I went to a brain doctor who scanned my brain, and he was saying that, like you just said, Jim, that it was like I had like no impulse control in my prefrontal cortex, and every time a beautiful woman walked past, or any woman really, didn't even have to be human. So small animals, cartoon characters, like it was something would just kind of light up, and I would just kind of sort of be distractible by that. So he was like, "You've trained yourself like a sort of hunter," and he said, "Well, you know, there's a point for dating and connecting. We're looking at options and dating and seeing different people, but at some point that needs to be kind of turned off so you can then engage in the next part of being a human being, which is, you know, having a family and children and continuing on the species."
Right. And did it take long to turn that off, Neil?
A few years. Yeah. It honestly did. Like, it really did. I think it's interesting. I don't know how people here feel, but it just seems that the culture, you're sort of, you know, you're in high school and you're in college, and I don't know about you and your friends, but it was really about kind of going out and meeting members of the opposite sex and trying to hook up. It's really what it was about. But then when you get in a relationship, okay, now I got to stop doing that. And it's sort of like, well, what's the ritual? What's the ritual in our culture that allows us to let go of that and move on to the next phase of adulthood? I don't think there is that ritual. Other cultures have it. We don't.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there was, and the book is quite detailed about this. There was, let's call them slippages. You know, when you decided you were going to go on the straight and be monogamous and like stay with your girlfriend Ingrid, right. You know, you kind of like slipped around. You're quite honest and brutally honest in the book about that. You know, and like did that, looking back now, did that hurt you? That unfaithfulness? Did it hurt you? Did it kind of like did it bring you back? Did it take you back? Did it kind of stop you from, I suppose, rewiring your brain?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, first of all, everything bad that happened turned out to be good in the end, right? So all the dark, you have to go through the dark to get to the light sometimes. So now Ingrid and I both agree that all that stuff was the best thing that ever happened because we got to both work on healing and work on the relationship and learn all this stuff. But of course it hurts you, and of course you hurt someone else. And like the pain, I mean, the pain of knowing that I hurt someone I loved and cared about, and the pain of knowing that I sabotaged our future together, the pain of thinking, well, if I love somebody, is sex so important to me that I'm going to hurt her, lie to her, break my own moral and ethical code just to get some? Like, there must be something wrong with me.
Did you find when you were writing The Truth? I mean, there's some very colorful passages
And by the way, I just thought of something, which is funny because it's casual, we get to talk about it. I don't care how many people are in relationships. I'm just kind of curious. Cool, awesome. Someone has some doubt; they're not sure. Okay. So Because there's another thing. It's not just like we define cheating as sort of having sex. There's another thing guys do that people do called grooming. Do you guys know what grooming is? Do you know what grooming is?
No.
Grooming is...
Well, I know
does anyone, anyone have a guess of what grooming is? Or like when you're grooming? Any guesses?
Is that like...
No.
That's one user.
What's that?
When you kind of line something else up just in case what you're in fails?
Yeah, it's grooming. It's like, oh, I'm in a relationship, but I'm kind of going to keep these people on the hook. There's some nodding going on. I'm going to keep these people on the hook just in case it doesn't work out, or so I know I'm still attractive, or so that later there's something to go back to. I don't want to burn all the bridges behind me. So I guess I won't do a show of hands since people's partners are here. But think about, I see some guilty smiles. So think about how many times you're grooming. So, and again, and you're caught doing that, that can break trust just as much as actually cheating.
You don't still go through the practice of grooming, do you?
No. I've 100% honesty and transparency with Ingrid.
Yeah. Getting back to the previous question, Daniel. It's in the book that you do the reporting on the kind of like the commune, the sex parties in Europe. You know, and like it's vivid. Was that kind of like? I'm curious. Was that a journalist thing? As in, like, you were going here to report on these, or were you actually kind of like going to get your rocks off?
Definitely, it's a fun job, but but no, I was definitely going for the experience. If I wasn't a journalist, I would still be there, getting my rocks off. but what Jim's referring to is, so I decided originally. The funny thing about writing books, I don't know if it's true for everybody, but I sit down with an idea, always have an idea for a book. By the end of the experience, it's never, that idea usually changes. I just let the book dictate what it's going to be about. Like The Game was never going to be about me. I was just going to profile the main kind of gurus in that community and talk about their life, and I wasn't going to be in it, but I ended up in it. So with this, I sat down, I decided monogamy doesn't work. Curious, it's probably more so in the States, but here's anyone in a non-monogamous relationship? Nobody. Interesting. If I ask that in the States,
no one's prepared to admit it.
No, but yeah, maybe they're saying anyone in a non-monogamous doesn't want to admit it. So I decided that at least in the States, the divorce rate's 50%. What's that? But she doesn't know about it. I heard that. You know what they call it? Consensual non-monogamy now. So that means that it's the honest consensual non-monogamy.
Consensual non-monogamy.
Yeah, CNM is consensual non-monogamy. So that means there's a lot of people are non-monogamous. And by the way, the whole idea of we're all non-monogamous because the truth is monogamy is mating for life. So if we're being with other partners, even individually, separately, we're still really technically non-monogamous. Anyway, so the question was...
Back to sex parties.
Oh, yeah, sex parties. So so I decided the divorce rate's so high, the remarriage, and all these stats, you can look at them until you're blue in the face, but only 38% of married couples describe themselves as happy in that state. Over 90% of couples become less happy after the birth of their first child. 3 out of 100 people were not fathered by the father they think is their parent. So in this room, that's maybe like 5 people, by the way, right? Think about it.
We haven't stuffed that many people in.
Exactly. So it's about 100 here?
80.
Okay, 2.5 of you. Yeah. Right. So and also, there's literally nothing in science that shows monogamy is natural. So I started this book, I'd say almost like saying, fuck this, why am I doing this? It's something the Catholic Church just in the 9th century decreed, and why am I going along with this story? So I thought, let me just find a relationship that's natural, that's true to me and who I am. And because that's, I mean, let me ask you, I keep asking questions, but it's fun for me. I don't get a focus group often. Writing's a solitary experience, unlike sex parties. Okay, so. How many people here have some fear, trepidation, or feel like it may be unnatural to just be romantically and sexually with one person going forward now for the rest of your life, just one person? That's a little scary, right? It doesn't totally make... How many people are excited about that? Nobody. So one person half raised his hand to be a rebel. And so the rest of you are just kind of liars, right? So, it didn't make sense. So I thought, as Chris Ryan, he wrote a book called Sex at Dawn about kind of evolution and the way we're kind of wired. He said, why do we put sex and love are like wine and cheese. They're nice together, but they don't have to go together. So I just thought I'll find a new relationship that's natural to me. And I started exploring the swinger communities and the polyamory communities and open relationships and all this other stuff. And that's where the sex parties came in.
And when you were exploring those particular communities, you know, where did you find people who were happy campers? Were they happy, or did you, were they deep down, were they fucked up like everyone else?
Yeah, here's the thought. Whatever relationship style you choose, there is no style that's unhealthy. It's only the individuals doing it that are unhealthy. So I found unhealthy and healthy people in every single one. So I think it's when people say, well, that doesn't work, it's the people in it that don't work. Yeah. And it's also, if somebody, there's something called the burning period. The burning period is if you want to sort of transition from monogamy to something that's more of an open relationship or non-monogamous, it takes a couple years to work out all the kinks, to get comfortable with it, to let go, to work on your jealousy issues, to get to a really high level of communication and emotional maturity, the abandonment fears, everything else. So it takes time to adjust, just like it took time for those first relationships went wrong. So I think the answer is everything works if you're healthy.
Yeah.
Nothing works if you're not.
Yeah, I mean, you're now married. You're a father. Right. You know, when you look back at your pickup years, you know, I mean, how do you regard people who are still in that community? I mean, do you look upon them kind of like as, because in the book again, you talk about those days, and you get a sense that there's an awful lot of troubled people, tormented people there. Do you look upon those people kind of like as kind of like people you want to save in any way, people you want to reach out to, or do you look upon them as sad sacks?
Oh, for sure. The first signing I did for the book, and no one had read it yet, was in New York. There were a lot of kind of game guys, but we started getting like deep into why they were there, into the esteem issues and the deeper reasons they were there. And it was kind of like it was fascinating to watch. And it kind of made me realize like the game may be what you want, but the truth is what you need. You know, and the best thing that can ever happen, I know you interview a lot of celebrities as well, is like all these people I interview for Rolling Stone who are at the top of their game, who got their entire dreams come true. You know what happens when you get to the top?
There's nowhere else to go.
No, you get really depressed. And you know why you get really depressed? Is because you thought like fame or money would, or in the case of the game, you know, sexual access, sexual sex, would heal something and make you feel better. When you finally get it and you still feel shitty or even worse, then you got to look inside and say, okay, something's wrong with me.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. Because before, when they're climbing the ladder, the fame ladder or the career ladder or the money ladder, they can think, okay, I'm down, but once I get there, it'll be okay. And when you get there and it's not okay, you look inside.
Yeah. It's interesting because, I mean, like, since the game came out, there has been various portrayals of kind of pickup artists in popular culture. There was that film Shame with Michael Fassbender, for example. You know, and that what you just described there, that depression, that sense of kind of, like, I mean, hopelessness, that sense of kind of reaching somewhere and not being able to go anywhere else, that comes clearly across. So it's almost as if the narrative around pickup artists has become very much like you just described.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. It's sort of, I'd also think too, like we're starting to realize in our culture that drugs aren't the only addictions. That anything you're doing to like avoid connection and avoid pain, even whether it's sex or it's work or obsessive exercising seems healthy, but when you're doing it to people do it to such an obsessive degree and they're never home for their families and they're like, you know, going to be in a wheelchair by the time they're 35, like it's addictive.
Yeah. One of the people in the book, and I didn't expect to see him there, is Rick Rubin. Right. Like, are you long-time friends? I know this is kind of a curveball question, but I was curious. Like, I mean, are you long-term friends? Like, has he been a bit of a kind of guru to you?
Yeah, it's not a curveball question. So Rick is because I was covering music, we've been friends for a while. And he watched me through the game. I even remember him being over at Project Hollywood and reading him some chapters from the game. And when it's interesting, I haven't said this before, but when I read him the game, he's like, you know what? I don't think it's finished yet. And I'm like, oh, you're just being a producer, it's done. And the truth was, it wasn't finished yet. This kind of is the completion of it.
Yeah.
And it was him who was saying, look, you got everything you wanted. Why is your life still so dramatic? And why are you not happy? So he was the one who kind of opened up that door to me.
Yeah.
And throughout the book, he's sort of, it's great to have a friend who can be really honest with you and tell you when you've lost your way.
Yeah. He's very zen as well. Did you buy into that?
What do you mean by buy into it?
Like, did you kind of go along with that as well? He's very zen. He's very grounded. He's like, you know, that interview you did in New York Times a couple of years ago, we talked about his business practices. He's very grounded, very straight about things,
right.
Very philosophical. Was that something that appealed to you?
Let's see. I'm trying to think of the question. I felt like he had a wisdom that I could benefit from listening to and being open to.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's move on then to kind of like mean the truth. It's out right
sure.
now. And I'm curious as well, because when the game came out, you did an awful lot of seminars, you did an awful lot of kind of workshops, and like,
right.
you know, you made good money from that side of things. You're still involved in that right now, aren't you? You've got the society.
Yeah, kind of what I did and was really cool is that as I was kind of learning this stuff and guys were coming to learn the game and pick up stuff. I said, hey, man, there's some cooler stuff over here that, like, you might be super into. And so as I was going through some of these experiences that were, like, really, like, ripping open your wounds and, like, you know, really pain exercising stuff, pain that I didn't even realize I had, I started bringing guys through that experience. And it really helped the book because I got to see, like, okay, this isn't just me. This is connecting with other people. Here's the things that are relevant to it. Here's a way to communicate about it. So in a way, it was really helpful to that. And I also found that if you get what you need from yourself, if you try to get what you need from someone else, and that's what the game was, right? Hey, if this person's willing to be naked with me, maybe I'm okay. Maybe I'm kind of cool, right? But it's just like a fix, right? Then they go away and you feel shitty again. But I found that once guys got it, once you got that self-esteem from the inside and got rid of some of that shame, not only would you have more success, but you wouldn't need it so bad.
Yeah. What's been the reaction, Neil, of kind of like me, I suppose, hardcore game adherence to the new book? Do they see you as betraying them? Do they see you as kind of like just like as wimping out and moving on?
Yeah, that wimp is the thing they all say. Like, dude, you're a fucking wimp. You got married and sold out. You got a child. You're fucking lame. They're like, no, I don't know. No, not that I know of. You guys can tell me. But I mean, the way I think I see it, and I think they see it, is, again, like, there's sort of this, like, there's this convenient cultural narrative, and it's like the headlines, like, pickup artist retires and does monogamy. But I think anyone here who's read the game knows, like, that's not really what it's about. There's a certain stage in life where dating and meeting members of the opposite sex or the same sex is like an exciting thing for you, and you want to do that. And then there's a stage of life where you kind of, and all along, you know, eventually you want to meet the right person, I want to get married, and I want to settle down. It's not like there was never any point in my life where I wanted to be a pickup artist the rest of my life, ever. Like, I'm definitely insane, but not that insane, right? Right? I'm not that, despite all those diagnoses, right? Like, there wasn't narcissistic personality disorder, in which case maybe that would have been my thing, right? So
in that case, I mean, did you have a best before date in mind?
What's that?
Did you have a best before date in mind? Did you have a date when, like, you were going to
stop? Oh, no, I just thought, like, I'd be ready. I just wanted to sometime, the best before date was, like, so I'm not so old to, like, I can't play ball with my kid. Right. So I felt like I was ready. I felt like after the game, I'd gone through that. Now it was time to start thinking about that person. But the thing I was going to say was, I think anyone who reads the game and the response has been like, cool, I was ready for this book. I was waiting for this book. I was ready for it now. Does anyone here have like a hard time with the fact? It seems normal to me, like it'd be pathologically insane to just want to be a pickup artist the rest of your life and never want to be in a relationship, I think. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the weird news cycle where they have to kind of put everything in a little box and be like, that's the box you're in. And while you're trying to get out of that box, like, no, back down. We need somebody to hate, right? Or somebody to kind of put all this stuff on. Because even the game isn't advocacy. There's good and bad stuff in the game about this community and culture, but there needs to be somebody. So we'll see what happens. And again, I don't really care what box I'm in the culture. It doesn't really matter to me. It's fun, right? It's a game. It's not serious. But it'd be fun. Someone else will. There's always somebody that they'll have. There's always got to be the most beautiful man in the world, the most beautiful woman in the world. There's always got to be like the villain and the Antichrist who's ruining the world. Like there are different roles, and the media needs people in those roles.
Yeah. I'm curious when the game was a success, and like suddenly you were like, the person everyone wants to kind of like talk to. When men came up asking you for advice, did it make you laugh? Did it surprise you, or was it a huge ego boost? And at that stage, you were living the dream anyway, so you're quite happy to indulge them.
No, it was pretty trippy. Like, I definitely thought as I was giving advice, like, dude, I'm just like, I was like this nerdy rock critic. Why am I like giving this advice? It was like, I'd be outside myself watching myself do it. I remember the day the book came out, like my phone rang literally within hours the day it came out. And some guy, I pick it up and he's like, oh, hey, is this Neil Strauss? I'm like, yeah. He's like, you know, I just had a question. There's this girl and one girl in my class. Then like it rang again. I'm like, oh shit, it's on. Yeah.
You should have started a hotline.
Yeah, exactly. Seriously, right?
You mentioned earlier on about like when you're talking about the game and pickup artists, about masculinity and kind of like to focus on masculinity. What's your take on the state of masculinity today?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, like I think the Telegraph or something wanted me to write a piece about like masculinity, and this is their take for my piece. They would say why men need to get in touch with their emotions. I'm like, first of all, nobody needs to do anything, right? What are you dictating to somebody what they need to do? You're like insane. And also, like, why are emotions, like, that? Just that sentence shows so many bad things. It's not like emotions are good and non-emotions are bad. Like, people, like, there's healthy emotions, there's unhealthy emotions. It's like, there was so much stupidity in that idea. And also, so my main thought is, trying to be masculine or feminine or anything is probably a mistake, right? Like trying to fit yourself into any kind of genre or box of what you should be like is like a losing battle or game. And I think that's where our culture is going anyway.
You reckon, like, be a lot more fluid?
I hope so. I mean, I think that's where we're seeing, I think if you want to say there's one good side of seeing these kind of hateful subgroups pop up is that because they feel fear and they feel threatened, which means maybe the culture is changing.
Yeah, it's interesting as well. I mean, all those kind of like mean subcultures and all those kind of like mean hate groups are popping up online, you know, and like, I mean, that's a virtual world. Whereas like in the case of the game, in the case of pickup artists, they were operating in real life. I can't imagine there's many pickup artists who are like being perfecting their Tinder game, for example.
Well, here's the interesting thing about Tinder. And for sure, again, it's sort of like, yes, whatever way there is to meet partners, people are going to use. It doesn't matter whether if it was the personals or it's, you know, city before that, it was probably like going to your, you know, to your church, you know, whatever it was, or at school. So I met with one of the founders of Tinder. And he said, one of the reasons we started Tinder was because of the game. Well, I go, in what way? He said, it just sounded like a lot of work. And he said, if I could just cut to the chase and know whether she likes me or not, everything would be so much easier. And that was one of the reasons he created Tinder. Then, because you start from the perspective of knowing she likes you, and then you blow it, right? It's amazing to me. It kills me. It's the same. And people always ask, oh, has Tinder changed the game? No, it's the same shit. Like, you're stupid and needy, or don't pick up on the clues and the signals, and you're out. It's the same dumb mistakes. You take them less personally because you're not directly interacting with the person.
Last question for me before we take a break. And yeah. Thank you very much for your time, Neil. I really appreciate you coming along. You said earlier on about, like, I mean, the way people in society put people in boxes, you know, and you'll always be known as a guy who wrote the game, you know. I mean, you've written the truth now about, like, I mean, where you stand currently in life. Do you think there's going to come a time when people won't associate you with the game? Do you think there's going to be a time when your kid gets older, when he starts reading and finding out that the game won't be the first thing that comes to mind when people talk about Neil Strauss?
I mean, who knows? I mean, my hope is they just associate me with just writing awesome books that you want to read front to back.
Okay. Neil Strauss, thank you very much.
All right, thank you, guys.
Okay, we're going to take a break for about 10, 15 minutes, let you stretch your legs and talk to one another in real life, and then we'll come back and get some questions from you in about 15 minutes. Thank you. Okay, folks, welcome back to Banter here at MVP. You've heard the questions I've had to ask. Some of you probably read the questions are on my sheet of paper that I stupidly left behind me, so you know the questions that I didn't ask. This is the time of the night when we turn to yous and ask, what questions you've got? So just put your hand up and we'll get the microphone to you. Unless you're at the very back, in which case you're just going to shout. Wow, they're all gone shy.
That's why they're here.
Yeah. Hi, Neil.
Oh!
Hi, Neil. So, I was wondering, now, because I haven't read the truth yet, and you might say there, but are you now in a monogamous relationship? Or are you... So, how do you classify yourself now?
Awesome. Great question. So I think it doesn't give away the book to say that, yeah, that I classify myself by trying not to classify myself. So what Ingrid and I said was just there are three entities in the relationship. There's me, there's her, and the relationship. And so every moment we do whatever's right for all three entities in the relationship. So it's not sort of, you know, it seems just strange to make a rule. It's like saying I'm going to write for the Irish Times for the rest of my life. Or, you know, it's like you might want to write for some other places, right? So what we do is...
Do you want to write for the Irish Times the rest of your life?
What's that? I do. That's our goal.
I'll let the other know.
You can hook it up. Thank you.
No problem at all. Just talk to me afterwards.
So that's our relationship, is just being true to those three entities in every moment, whatever it may be.
So that's not a yes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, so it's sort of like a rejection. It's a rejection of the whole idea. You can say, hey... Have you slept with other people? You can say that's a different question than are you monogamous or non-monogamous. It's a rejection of, here's what I found. And I think especially with relationships, the answers to most questions can be found by questioning the premises themselves. So even this idea of monogamy or non-monogamy doesn't seem like, does it serve the relationship? Does it serve the partners to say that? So things may change. For example, I did a radio show for a while, and the sound engineer... his wife went through menopause, and after a few years, he's like, you know what? I think I really got to start having sex. And so they sort of renegotiated their relationship. So the answer is, we're just kind of open to whatever's right for all of us. Cool.
Next question. Yep.
Hi, Neil. Is it a baby boy you have?
Yes, it's a little baby boy.
Okay, this becomes relevant.
Yeah. Why is it that people want me to have a daughter?
No. It is relevant to the question, I promise.
Okay.
So I'm just wondering, with your baby boy, when he's 16 or 17, will you be recommending that, maybe not reads the game, but will you be recommending that he like kind of learns a bit about the things that govern seduction and the things that will help him attract ladies, or would you prefer that happens naturally?
Yeah, my hope is that I raise him with enough self-esteem that he doesn't need to read books about this shit. but for real, like I really think about that when one thing that parents don't do is they don't allow children to healthily separate as they get old enough in teenage years to begin that process of separating. Like, I'm sure there's some people here and your parents are still trying to parent you. It's not healthy, it's pointless, it's useless, and they don't allow that. But if you allow someone to separate healthily and with self-esteem, they can then go on maybe and live their life. So my hope is that I raise him in a way that he doesn't need any of my books, but maybe enjoys a story about his dad when he's 30.
Yep.
Hey, so I've read The Truth, and the most shocking thing about it, I suppose, is your honesty about yourself in it. But not just that, your honesty about other people, especially your parents. So how did they react to everything that you put in the book about them, about your relationship with them, and things like that?
Would you be scared to say that stuff about your parents?
I'm glad I don't have to.
You just don't know.
There's bits, but nothing of the magnitude that did your parents. And yeah, you know, I'd be honest about it with friends and stuff like that. The stuff there. I'll be honest here. You know, my dad had an affair, but you know, so it's not something that doesn't happen in
right. Hundreds. How old were you?
Separated when I was 12.
Right, so when you were 12 and you knew your dad had an affair.
I didn't know then.
You didn't know then? No. When did you find out?
18, 19.
That's great. That's awesome they protected you from that information, because it's not something you need to know at 12. That's awesome. Good for them.
But yeah, so, you know, your honesty in it.
Right.
How did they react to that?
So the answer is I don't really know. I'm not sure if they've read it or not, but and what he's referring to, and I won't ask you your name since you've now divulged your family secrets here. So what he's referring to is I'm really open about my family. And the reason I think I could be open was two reasons. One is, I don't know, for some reason I'm able to write things I can't say. Like, even if anyone read Rules of the Game, there's a story in the beginning about like a sexual experience I had that was highly embarrassing with like a neighbor who was very, very old. And had like a colostomy bag or something. Exactly. That's why I had to write about it. I wanted to get that reaction. So I'm able to write about. So for some reason, writing is the way I just communicate best. But secondly, is when I did all of my books with different rock stars and popular culture figures, I said the rule is you have to put everything in the book. You can't worry about what your friends think. You can't worry about what your kids think or your wife thinks or your family thinks. Like, just don't write a book if you're going to hold back and deprive the reader of a part of your life. So I had to hold myself to those same standards. And I've often found, too, you really don't know. You don't know what someone's reaction is going to be. And so I thought I wouldn't second guess it. I did tell him. I said, hey, there's going to be shit going down in this book. and I said, if you want, I can change your names. Like, change where you live and change your identifying details so you can just tell your friends that, you know, my son is a liar and made it up, so you have plausible deniability. But they didn't go for that option. So I did give them... I'll give everyone a chance to get out of it. Because the story's what matters, not whether what someone looked like or what their name is.
Hi. One of the things that was kind of glossed over earlier on was kind of the rape culture aspect that was kind of attached to the game. But there's been other books that have been kind of a lot worse in that sense. Say, Tucker Max, I Serve Beer in Hell, or Hope to Serve Beer in Hell. I was just wondering, have you ever read that book and what's your opinion on it? Or like a lad culture sort of idea.
I read part of the books, but what's interesting is Tucker Max and has actually gone through his like years of psychotherapy, is now married with a child, and has stopped doing that kind of writing. So it's interesting that he had his own similar sort of growing up experience. So it's interesting.
That lad culture, though, you mentioned lad culture, didn't you?
The rape culture.
Yeah, but that whole rape culture, lad culture. I mean, that, like, you know, when the game was kind of published in 2005, I mean, 10 years previously, you've kind of seen that lad culture, athletic culture kind of comes to the fore. It's interesting to kind of look at the 10-year kind of specs, you know, and now with kind of like that rape culture, that kind of culture, everything's changed, you know what I mean? Those, that kind of permissiveness that you kind of had 10 years ago when the game was what came out, it just seems to have kind of like been, it's very, very changed, very, very changed kind of playing ground.
Yeah, yeah, so I don't know. I just hope whatever that is, that the game is not a part of it. And I don't think anyone has said that I've read. I don't know. Yeah. But to me, the game was a book about, to me, the game was ultimately a book about male insecurity. And when I wrote it, it wasn't saying, hey, guys, go. So I think the question, you know, it's interesting because, again, like, there's what the game was to me and what it is to people who read it, then there's what it is kind of when you read about it. So, you know, when I wrote it, it wasn't saying, hey, this is awesome. Everybody fucking go do this. It's the greatest thing ever. It was sort of saying there's this weird world. Here's my experience in it. Here's what I thought that was good and bad. There were for sure 100% people in that book who were, you know, just, let's just say, you know, and were even called out as being, like, problematic, you know, really problematic individuals. So what was my point? My point was this. My point was, like, to me, I couldn't write it now because I've changed, but what's going on in the culture doesn't, what's going on, say, outside of the world of my eyes and my experience and my writing doesn't really influence what I say. I'm going to speak to whatever's true for me, I will always put in a book. And that's all I know is what I experience. So what's, yeah.
Hi, Neil. Hey. First of all, I just want to say thank you for this evening and also for allowing Tim Ferriss, giving, like, helping Tim Ferriss name his book, because he's also been very influential in my life.
Great.
My question is has to do with personality types and the fact that you're a creative and the fact that you'd spend most of your life kind of facing rejection and having to constantly put yourself out there. Do you think that that actually had a bigger role to play in how successful you were in the PUA community? And because there were other people that were there before you who did not have the kind of success you had and things like that. Do you think that being a creative and all the kind of things that you have to go through developing yourself as a creative person in terms of writing and things like that actually had a bigger role and probably is responsible for your hardwiring during the brain scan rather than just the PUA stuff you did?
All right, so let me see if I understand the question. So do you think all the stuff I did prior to that community enabled me to what?
To be very successful within that community.
Oh, got it. Yeah. I mean, I think it definitely helped because doing all those interviews, I think doing all those interviews and talking to all these people helped me have some experience and things to talk about for sure. But I think what enabled me more than anything is like just the ability to curiosity and the willingness to learn. I think those more than anything were, and that's probably what drew me to writing, is the same thing that made me successful, is really being curious and being willing to learn and not sort of judging right away and being skeptical right away, just really, really, really being open to it.
Next question.
Hi, Neil. Just a quick thing that sort of came up, stuck with me during your interview just now, was when you mentioned the article you had to write where the theme was men need to get in touch with emotions, you seemed very anti against that idea, that you need to do this. But arguably, nowadays, there's a lot more of a movement towards men should be sort of getting in touch with emotions a lot more to actually develop, because we live in this lad culture kind of world where we're not told to feel anything because we're men. So I was just wondering why you sort of reacted so harshly to this idea that men need to get in touch with emotions.
I think taking anything as an entire group, number one, it's bad just to say this entire group, making a generalization and a stereotype. So part one is just saying that. Are there women who need to get in touch with their emotions? Are there men who don't need to get in touch with their emotions? Of course, there are plenty of men in touch with their emotions. So number one is taking a broad blanket and just cutting a line right here by gender. So that's part one. Part two is I'm really into nonviolent communication. A guy named Marshall Rosenberg wrote a book and has some audio stuff on it. He recently passed away, but it's really great stuff. And saying that anybody needs to do something is right away dictate. It's like it's being a dictator. It's like telling them what they need to do, right? So the second thing is like just saying it's so problematic in our culture, right? I'm sure a lot of people believe that the world needs to bow before the certain god or die, right? And they may really feel that they're really right because they're right in that cultural sphere. But I think that kind of thinking is the kind of thinking that leads to violence and hate. So that's my problem with it.
Hi, Neil. So today the book has this sort of, there's a lot of groups that look at it with a bit with contempt. But for us, there's a lot of people that the book was very beneficial. So for us, it's a bit confusing how you transform someone who is socially anxious, that doesn't have any friends, girls don't want to look at you, and then this book comes along and really transforms you. So is it really, do you look back and say, that's really bad, and what's the alternative? What will be the alternative?
Yeah, yeah. No, I hear what you're saying. Like, I think it's really confusing because you write books because these worlds are nuanced. Shit is nuanced. It's not like there's, you know, these giant things and this is bad and this is good. Like, shit is nuanced, but a newspaper headline is not nuanced, right? So again, some of the questions feel like they come from the world of media and not from the world of personal experience, right? And even why are law books, I don't know who's a lawyer, but I mean, they're just trying to create these codes of human behavior, and even they don't work, even though books and books and books and books written by wise people, they don't work. So things are nuanced, and my thought is this. This is where I stand now, just my personal stance on it. And again, like, I would just avoid being shamed out of anything by the media. If stuff is good for you and it works for you and it doesn't hurt anyone else, I think that's a positive thing. So, but where I stand on it is, like, absolutely, if you're shy and awkward and uncomfortable and you have social anxiety, you want to meet people and you want to connect with people, by all means, please work to become more confident, to have less shame, to, you know, connect. And then the question is, are you doing it in an authentic way or an inauthentic way? Are you doing it in a manipulative way toward an outcome? Are you doing it just sort of to become a better person and connect more? So maybe that's where the real difference in my thinking now is, that I probably think any type of manipulation is not a good thing, right? However, connecting with others, getting over shame, getting over social anxiety, seeing people as equals, not as someone who's going to like be the judge of your entire self-esteem, you know, these are good things to learn no matter what. So I think no matter what, it's not like, oh, the game is over and I'm done with that. I always want to help and support people learning to become better, social, more connected people. Does that make sense? Well, yeah.
I think that's what the game did for a lot of people.
I think so too, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, it's not maybe as negative as some people portray to be, because for people who were maybe very solid, had a very solid grounding, but there was maybe that aspect of not being able to, I don't know, create attraction or whatever it is, those small things made a huge difference for those. So people who didn't take it to maybe the extreme, it was very positive for them. So I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's true. And again, the game show, the good and bad. It's so weird. Like, it's like, it's fascinating to hear questions, because like we could probably sit here and talk forever about what the game is and what it means. It's cool to have written a book that's like so, you know what I mean? That's so feared and yet so helpful and yet so strange and yet so this and that. And again, like, I think the thing is, you can find your own path through it. I mean, the end says to win the game is to leave it. So obviously it's not saying do this for the rest of your life. And for me, just speaking personally for me, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Like, I went through some dark times. There were probably some times where I would look at myself and probably not like myself, but it showed me it was possible to change and transform. So for my personal outcome was great. So cool.
Just some questions to the back, actually. Yep. And for a moment as well, excellent. We did a banter.
Because we need to get in touch with our emotions, damn it.
It reminds me of a banter we did like this before on masculinity. Very similar. Uh-huh.
Right.
Sorry.
I was wondering, did the change to make the truth come from meeting Ingrid? Like, had you not met Ingrid, do you think you would have gone through this?
Yeah, it's a good question. Did it come from meeting Ingrid? For sure, there's a part of the truth that kind of love inspires one to change. And I think more so than that, the fact that I loved her and then cheated on her and betrayed her and hurt her, like, that was the moment when I'm like, something, why would I do that? Something's wrong with me. So for sure, maybe it would have been someone else, I don't know, but for sure it was like Ingrid, my love for her, and my complete inability to be functional with that or live up to it anyway. Absolutely, the truth wouldn't exist without that. Good question.
Next question. Yeah, at the door.
I was just going to say that emergency and kind of how that fits into the other two books. How do you think that transition from the emergency onto the true?
Yeah, no, I love that you asked that, because things get so focused on the game, which is great, but I kind of just see things as a continuum, which is, I wrote, to me, a lot of my books are just looking for father figures, trying to grow myself up. So the game was, you know, having that dad who says, like, hey, there she is, son, go talk to her, right? An emergency was the dad who says, like, you know, go takes me camping and teaches me how to take care of myself and to use tools and to sort of be a man in the world. And the truth is the dad who says, you know, if you love someone, just tell her you love her. Don't be scared. You know, a lot of my books are just finding the father figures that I, and you'll see there's a father figure almost in every book. So good point. Like, to me, I see him as a continuum versus this, like, the game is bad and the truth is good. It's not like that. I probably do worse things in the truth than I do in the game. I definitely do. Yeah.
Here, question here.
But I think it's important because I just hear all these questions like, fuck, man. Like, you got to know who you are. Like, and it's hard to know who you are and not just be a leaf blowing in the wind of the culture. The culture says this is good and this is bad and this you should do and this you shouldn't do. Like, you got to have, like, your personal, moral, ethical, you know, guidance system, you know, and live with that. Otherwise, literally, like, the culture is always fucking changing and there's so many loud voices. And also, you're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, so everything you do is getting immediate feedback. And if we like it, we don't like it, and you're sort of getting trained and shaped by the culture. You just got to be careful to know who you are, otherwise you're kind of going to waste this life. And there's a great book, and I haven't read it for a few years, a book by Milan Kundera called Life is Elsewhere. And what it's about is a young gentleman born to be a great poet. And what happens is between his mother issues and the kind of, I guess, the politics of the time, he becomes a total hack. And it's a great book for kind of asking yourself the questions you should be asking sometimes. I personally love that book. Yeah.
Have you surprised yourself with everything that has come out of the game between everything that's grown from it, the society, and walking out and being a mentor to so many people, the other books that have come from it? Have you just ever turned around and looked back and said, wow, how did all of this, you know, snowball out of that book? And does it ever amaze you as to what actually you've put together? Because as we're sitting here, I got an email for the money game right. As I was checking my mail, you know, all the things that have come from it. Does it surprise you?
Yeah, it's weird. Like, I don't look back at all. I just think, like, I have all these books that I need to write and all these other ideas that I have. I have 3 books under contract to HarperCollins that I got to get done. And I think 1 to Canongate probably too. So I just see all these books like fiery dogs from, like, dogs on fire. I don't know why I see them, like, chasing me. And I just got to hurry and write them before I die. So I'm just running ahead trying to write more. It's probably not healthy, but that's how I see it.
Yep, here.
Hi, thanks. I just have a question. You mentioned earlier, someone had mentioned about Tucker Max, about how, and you said he had gone through psychotherapy, and you yourself have been to rehab and worked on yourself. So what does that say, if anything, about, you know, you guys that write books like this?
Great. Yeah, it's a great question. Here's what it says. This is a great question. So I tried to think about this. I thought, okay, I wrote this book called The Game. Tucker Max wrote, you know, his books about kind of lad culture. A friend of mine, Robert Greene, wrote a book called The Outer Seduction, another one called The 48 Laws of Power. And I have some other friends who wrote books like this. And as I was kind of going through this journey, I would talk to these people about their stuff as I learned the stuff about myself. And I learned that we all had something in common. We all had one thing in common. And that thing was, we all had a narcissistic mom. So what it made me realize, and this is not blame, it's just understanding, but it made me realize is, okay, why does it happen that one writes a book like The Game or The Outer Seduction or whatever it is about having power over the opposite sex? It's because, well, you're so powerless to that parent growing up that now you're just sort of in total fear. So you're like, I need to have control and this power. So what it tells me is that, like, there are a lot of people with wounds, us included. And if instead of maybe fearing them or villainizing them or whatever it is, or, you know, which just makes them kind of react more, one can sort of be empathic to this wound and help them get help, maybe we can have a better culture and society and my thought is if we can just all look at our own wounds, we can become better. So to me, the exciting, like, if there's a message of the truth that I haven't been able to say in any interview because it's kind of complicated, is that, like, there's a quote that begins it, what we do not know controls us. I had no idea that I was, like, sort of being programmed and going kind of autopilot through life, through this sort of fear of the, you know, this sort of fear and reacting to it. So what it showed me is once I kind of recognized that, I could then treat it, get over it, and literally get past it. There's no way I could sit down now and write The Game. It would be literally impossible. I would never write. I can't even read it, so I could barely write it. So what it showed me is we all have these wounds, And if we were empathic to everybody's wounds instead of letting their wounds trigger our wounds, we can maybe have a better society and culture. Great question.
So then, would you say the game isn't the answer then to some guys who think it is the answer?
Nothing is the answer. Nothing is, the truth is not the answer. The Bible's not the answer. This is fucking, nothing is the answer. Right? Nothing's the answer.
Next question.
How's it going, Neil? You said you have 3 books signed up with HarperCollins that you're going to produce. You know there's a demand there for your books. You know there's a following, there's people who turn up. How do you end up keeping standards high when you kind of know, fuck, this shit's going to sell?
Yeah.
You know, so who's the guy who smacks you down and goes and says, this ain't good enough? Is it the editor or is it friends?
Who do you guys think it is?
You.
It's me. Yeah, I want to write a book called The Power of Low Self-Esteem because by really feeling like all the people I know, by feeling like, shit, it's not good enough. I can make this better. I'm so hard on myself. My editor was being like, let go of this book. I'm like, no, man, there's this part here. It's not quite right. And this part's off. He's like, that's dog whistle stuff. No one else can hear it but you. And I'm like, so my thought is I only release. Here's the deal for anyone creating art or culture or anything. I don't know if you'll agree, but it's only release it to the world once you're 100% happy with it. And then whatever happens doesn't matter. Literally, if this book failed and nobody was here, like, I still feel good about that, right? It shouldn't be dependent on the reward, right? So the answer is, like, I'd let it go when I feel good about it, and then whatever happens, happens. And that for sure is the person's me. And I've noticed I talk to a lot of successful people. It's not true of everybody, by the way. Some people just think anything they do is, like, the greatest thing ever, you know, humanity ever created, especially, like, a lot of the, like, in the Britpop era, all those bands. Like, I'd be, like, touring with them. They'd be, like, it was insane, the stuff they'd say about their music. What's that?
Like who? Names?
Oh, yeah. I remember, I'll give you a couple examples. I remember, like, I was interviewing, like, and the brand I was thinking actually was The Verve when they were kind of listening to their stuff. But I remember, like, I was interviewing Oasis, and I said, back in the 60s, like, if you were in the kind of the 60s and, like, where were you, you know, when you were making music at that time, do you think it would still be so well received? And one of them, they both had great answers. One says, it would be the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Oasis, and then the Who. And then the other brother said, "We would have been the Beatles." So they would be examples. And what music are they making now, right? But a lot of people I know who are really successful, they're really hard on themselves. They never feel like it's good enough, and it destroys themselves. But sometimes it's good for the art. Good question.
Two more questions. Woman over here. A guy over here. Yep.
Microphone
goes so far.
Yeah. No. Came this evening out of interest from a female point of view, but also from male friends' point of view too. But I hear you saying the same thing over and over throughout, and it's that we have to learn to validate ourselves, and we really can't expect anyone else to do that for us, whether it's a one-night stand or in the long term. But the therapy thing, can I just promote it to everybody here?
Sure.
You would not believe how your life can be changed by having a psychotherapist listen to you over the course of 6 months or a year. And there's more and more low-budget therapy services out there now where people are, they're in training, they're fully qualified, but they can't get paid full fees for a couple of years. And they're dying to help you, and they're good at their jobs, and it can turn your life around. And then you don't end up going chasing tail, taking drugs, whatever. And yeah, there's no answer, but you're a lot closer to finding your own if you just talk it out. And those wounds, they stop making you make bad decisions and stop looking for approval, and it's just fabulous. That's what I want.
Cool. Hi. So it's funny because there's... here's what I think, like, for sure, getting any... I think that's great. I'm happy that you spoke up for that. People said, oh, God, you know, it's like a shameful thing to get therapy in Dublin or something. I don't know if that's true or not. Good. That's good. I'm glad it's changing. But here's the thing. So I think the next level is this. So, like, here's the problem with talk therapy is great, for sure. But the deal with talk therapy is it's very, like, you know, prefrontal cortex, like, you know, intellectual. And a lot of the trauma and the pain and the stuff comes in through your feelings, right? It comes in there, and there's some awesome other stuff that's going on. There's something called somatic experiencing. They're like intense workshops, but if you can do things where you have feelings and move feelings around, it's like 10 times more powerful. So what I found worked for me actually was doing really deep, intensive work, like the stuff that's in the book that you'll read about, some of the chair work stuff, and then maintaining what I learned through the talk therapy. So the talk therapy to me was kind of for maintenance and some of the insights, but really moving that stuff. There's some like great stuff happening. And I think there's a problem in our culture, which is like, if you're sick, you go to a hospital, you know, but if you're sort of mentally sick, someone says, get over it, right? You know, people have it worse off than you, get over it. And, you know, so we work on our intelligence, we have to go to school, we work on our intellectual intelligence, if we're sick, we go to the hospital, but we're not really taught to have emotional intelligence. And I think really this book is about learning to have emotional intelligence.
Last question, this guy over here. Make it a good question.
Make it a good one.
No pressure whatsoever. Thanks for that. Yeah. One of the best things that we could say about all your books so far is that they really aim to help people and to help them like ask questions about themselves and develop their lives. So if you weren't to be a writer and you weren't to be a journalist, is there anything you think you could have done where you could have had the same sort of impact?
Well, it's funny. Like when I did Emergency, I thought I would be a paramedic. Yeah. Now that I'm doing this book, I think maybe I'd be a therapist, because like if there was time, I would definitely go into that stuff with you. But I can give you like a little hint to get over stuff. There's a great line in the book, and I think it's a common trope, which is where there's reactivity, there's a wound, right? So anytime you overreact disproportionately to someone, something, right? You get super angry, super stressed out. Other people like shut down and close off when you're not, your life's not really at threat. That's like a hint that there's something early in your life that really was a threat that made you have that reaction. So that's a fun hint, something to start with while you look up those hungry Dublin therapists.
Neil Strauss's books are for sale down there. You'll also be signing some books after us, please?
Sure.
Sure. So please give a warm round of applause and thanks to Neil Strauss.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks a million to Neil for taking part, and thanks to Cormac Kinsella and Angela Robertson from Canongate Books for their assistance. This Banter podcast was produced and polished by series producer Tanya White. If you've enjoyed this broadcast, please rate us and spread the word. Tell your friends about us, recommend us on your favourite social media network, leave a review or a rating on the iTunes store, and don't forget to subscribe. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news where we're up to at Banter, and we'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.